Deng the next day bumped into a retreating group made up of supply personnel from a Luftwaffe unit. After other men from various decimated units joined up with them, it was stop, and they were sent into the trenches. He was wounded somewhere south of Chir at the beginning of January.
"Shot through the thigh, with bone damage," says Weichert.
The convalescence took a long time, owing to complications caused by the wound constantly festering. Varias tells us that he was with a combat group until the middle of January. The group had slowly been retreating south, at the same time delaying the enemy. On the 17th of January 1943, he was wounded near Konstantinovka on the Don, when a grenade splinter caught him in the throat. We can see a deep scar under his left ear. "And what has happened to Gommel and Zeidel?" I ask. "Well, yes, he was with Zeidel for a while," he says. "But at the end of December, a grenade ripped away both his feet."
"He slowly bled to death before our eyes," Varias tells us quietly.
Then he is silent. We give him time to recover, but after he has had a chance to drink two more glasses of bear catcher, I raise the question of Gommel again. My guess is that he also has fallen. Varias nods and closes his eyes. When and how did it happen?
"A couple of days after you were wounded, near Nizhnechirskaya."
I can see little Gommel with his pale face and sad eyes in front of me. He couldn't open fire on the enemy, and as I watched him, he would simply close his eyes when he pulled the trigger. Why he acted like this, I will probably never know. Varias must have been reading my mind. He lays his hand on my arm.
"Yes, I knew about that as well. But a few hours before he died, he confessed to me that his religion forbade him to shoot people. 'In front of God, we are all brothers,' he said to me. But he was no coward. He saved my life and those of others before he died," Varias continued. "I will never forget that. It was during the fighting west of Nizhnechirskaya, where the day before we had fought back an enemy attack. During the night, the weather changed, and we were exposed to a heavy snowstorm. So we didn't realize the Russians were attacking until they actually stormed our positions. Thank goodness we had some tanks in support, which immediately fired on the attackers. But some of the Russians had already reached our trenches, and one big bull of a bloke sprayed us with his Kalashnikov like a madman. Suddenly he bent over and aimed his submachine gun directly at me and the others. I could already feel the hot rounds pumping into my body. Then some chap standing next to him jumped up and walloped him in the chest with his rifle butt. The Russian keeled over, and his Kalashnikov started to go off. The entire string went into this man's body, and he immediately fell back into the trench. We immediately shot the big Russian bully, but since the fighting was still going on, no one could concern himself about the fallen. We couldn't make out who it was because of the driving snow. It was only after we had beaten off the attack that we saw that it was our own little Gommel who had saved our lives. His body was literally riddled with bullets, and he was, of course, stone dead. When we pulled back, we carried all the dead bodies with us. Our little friend was buried with a lot of others in Nizhnechirskaya at the same time. We all went quiet after this, each man left with his own memories. Pictures keep appearing in front of my eyes, showing the many dead at the bridgehead on the Don, and most of the comrades I knew closely and who were important to me. But death takes no account of friendship, nor of the feelings of the survivors. 15th of March. I've been with the convalescent company for 4 weeks now. Varias's and Weichert's leave begins tomorrow, and so I'll go with them to the railway station to bid them farewell. Months will pass before we meet again. 2nd of May. Before I begin my travels, I can sew on a Gefreiter's stripe, along with which I receive a small increase in pay, although you can't buy much these days. I spend the summer holidays in an army convalescent home in Radom, Poland. The time passes pleasantly, and I recuperate well. Before long, it is the beginning of June 1943. The weather is beautiful, and at the end of it I have a fresh and healthy tan. 3rd of June.
The numbers of personnel in the convalescent company have gone down significantly during the last few weeks. Those who have been here the longest are slowly but surely being sent back to their units in northern France. The remaining units from our division in Russia are also stationed in France, so that they can be rebuilt with new recruits and those returning from convalescence. Chapter 7. Hunting Italian Partisans. It is the 11th of July. Back in the convalescent company, orders await me to report to the 1st Company of the 1st Battalion of the newly reconstituted division. Our company is currently stationed in Flers, in Normandy. I am one of a group of 14 soldiers, and we are being taken by truck to the railway station. 30th of July. During the next few weeks, we learn discipline. The main part of the work is to do with weapons and field training. Instead of the old MG-34, we now receive the brand new MG-42, which has the much higher rate of fire, 1,000 rounds a minute, and is far less susceptible to cold, wet conditions and dirt. Because of our earlier training, my friends and I are assigned to the company's heavy weapons platoon, and the company is again up to strength. While Otto Krupka, a good friend of mine from the convalescent company in Insterburg, Weichert and I get further training on the heavy machine gun, Varias has been assigned to mortars. Our instructors, from the Oberwachtmeister as Zugführer to the Unteroffiziere, are almost all experienced frontline soldiers, many of them decorated. The training is hard, but not vindictive. As I always accept and carry out to the best of my ability the hard, but very worthwhile training on the HMG, which apart from the firing exercises includes building gun positions and carting around the heavy mounting and the ammunition boxes, I do not feel any real desire to go out in the evenings. I know from experience how vitally important it is, during an emergency, to have a trained body and to be able to control your weapon perfectly. I'm convinced that these two things, plus my good luck and God's help, have helped me survive the war so far in one piece. 15th of August. It's time to say au revoir to France. No doubt many of the mademoiselles are weeping hot tears through their long eyelashes, but they will probably hanker after one of the many communications stallions and are quite prepared to expand their families. The departing soldier, on the other hand, sticks out his chest so that his medals rattle, assuming there are any to rattle, and reflects that a hot-blooded Mediterranean girl wouldn't be so bad after all. Although our destination is top secret, the rumour mill points in the direction of Italy. General Badoglio has assumed control of the government there and has arrested Mussolini, and there are concerns that he will pull out of the German-Italian axis. This is exactly what happens. First, we go by rail to Landeck in the Tyrol, and from there by truck to Meran. The welcome given to us by the local population is indescribable. It's as if everyone is having a party. The tarpaulin over the back of our truck bed is rolled up because of the heat. We wave from the vehicles and are nearly drenched in sweets, chocolate, fruit, wine, and huge quantities of flowers. We can only advance at walking pace, and hundreds of people are running alongside us, stretching their hands up to touch ours. Otto even lifts one beauty into the truck, and she goes from one to the other of us, kissing us intimately. She tells us that we are the very first German troops seen in southern Tyrol for 25 years. They fear the threatening storm clouds, and we gather that the population in southern Tyrol would be happy to be annexed to Germany. We stop overnight in Meran, and join the population feasting well into the night. 31st of August. The situation here in Italy becomes more and more critical every day. We are constantly on alert, but we carry on all the time with our field exercises. We sweat like pigs in our field grey uniforms. The Italian population is openly criticising Mussolini, who has apparently done everything wrong. The word is that Badoglio has opened peace negotiations with the Allies and wants to dissolve the pact Italy had with us. 3rd of September. We get our tropical uniforms at last, and we feel like holiday makers. The light uniforms look good, khaki-coloured shirts and shorts, to help us cope with the unusually hot conditions. British troops are said to have landed in southern Italy and to be moving north from Sicily. There are rumours going around that we might be transferred to Naples. 8th of September. The Italian population is told that a peace treaty is in place between Badoglio and the Allies. The war is over for them. Most of the population is jubilant, and as of now we find ourselves at war with former friends. Our orders are to disarm the Italian troops as quickly as possible. 9th to the 13th of September. Our first objective is the barracks in Modena. In the early morning hours, our company commander, with the help of a tank, is able to confuse the Italian commander of the barracks so completely that we are able to take possession of the place, without resistance, in one bold move. We take most of the soldiers by surprise while they are still in their beds. We are amazed that the Italian soldiers sleep in such huge rooms, an advantage from our point of view because we can win control over them quite easily. After they have been disarmed, they are turned over to an escort unit for onward transport. Then we're off to Bologna, and the next day to the barracks at Pistoia, where the operation is repeated. Another rumour says that the Allied invasion can be expected in the Legorn-Viareggio area. We've been told nothing officially. 14th of September. We set off in a westerly direction and take up a position in a forest between Pisa and Legorn. We hear that Mussolini has been rescued by German airborne troops and that he has been sent to the Führer's main headquarters. The expected invasion does not materialize. Instead, we are strafed continuously by enemy aircraft, although they cause no damage. The following days are quite pleasant. From the point of view of supplies, we are living a life of luxury. The supply depots which we captured during the disarming of the Italian army are filled to overflowing with all type of foodstuffs. Every day we get quite adequate rations of delightfully tasting grape marmalade, fresh butter and real mortadella. What's more, we eat crusty Italian white bread and drink delightful wine. Over the following weekends, we visit the Piazza della Signoria in nearby Florence and the Leaning Tower of Pisa, or drive with our Schwadron commander down to the beach of Legorn to go swimming. 20th of September. Unfortunately, we're being transferred again. First, we drive in a northerly direction over the Apennines, then northeast over Ferrara and Padua, and then along the Adriatic coast towards Trieste. On the way, there are some incidents with partisans, but we suffer only very minor losses. Our motor sergeant has problems with the captured Italian vehicles, so, because I hold all the army driver's licenses, I am pressed into service. First, I take over a heavy Italian motorcycle and sidecar, though I do not have the pleasure of riding it for long. I quickly get used to the weight of the machine, even though, unlike our motorcycle combinations, it has the sidecar on the left-hand side. During the zigzagging drive through the Apennines, I suddenly have engine trouble and almost disappear into oblivion down a mountain gorge. The problem must have been due to either the carburettor or the ignition, because while sweeping round the bends, the engine would suddenly cut out, and as a result I would get left behind. When I then, in my annoyance, revved up, the engine suddenly kicked in, and the machine took a giant leap forward. Although I normally would get the runaway motorbike quickly under control, on one very tight right-handed bend, I'm no longer able to control it. The machine accelerates over to a retaining wall on the left-hand side of the road, coming to a halt halfway over the edge of the abyss. The Schiermeister helps me push the machine completely over the edge into the gorge, so that it will not fall into the hands of the partisans. I then take over a VW Jeep, which initially gives me a lot of trouble. When I drive it, the lightweight vehicle weaves all over the road, and I am just thankful that no one is coming towards me. I'm behind the wheel of a passenger car for the first time. My military driver's licenses, Class 1 and 2, were gained on a 5-ton Henschel diesel truck with rough double declutching and steering, which could only be done by brute force. So I spend the next quarter of an hour working hard to get used to the foibles of this lightweight go-kart with its sensitive steering wheel, and eventually manage to drive along with the rest of the convoy to the satisfaction of the motor sergeant. 23rd of September. We've reached our destination and are spending the whole day in the assembly area. I have to give up my VW Jeep, as I'm considered much more important as a machine gunner. 25th of September. Our unit and others are hunting down partisans on the Istrian Peninsula. Members of Badoglio's partisan movement have holed themselves up in very difficult and rough terrain, in many cases in caves. Thus we have a physically demanding job to do, most of the time on foot, since our vehicles can get around only with difficulty. 27th of September. We capture two armed partisans and a woman in the houses. They couldn't get away in time. A Feldwebel I do not know wants to shoot them at once, and along with them the few remaining residents of the houses, who insist that they were forced by the partisans to let them use their homes. After a discussion with the two other Feldwebeln, he agrees to let the residents go free and takes the prisoners along. As we continue on our way, Fritz Hamann and I are the last two in the group. The Feldwebel waits with the prisoners for us to catch up. Then he orders us to take them behind the rocks and shoot them. We're totally shocked, and we tell him to find someone else to do the job. He gets extremely angry and yells, "That is an official order! Those swine have fired on us and wounded our comrades. They could even have killed them. And we can't drag that riffraff along." He points to the rocks behind us with his submachine gun. "You can do it over there, in the gorge." Fritz Hamann now shouts so loudly that his voice echoes from the mountainsides. "Get going, you swine!" We force the prisoners off the road and back into the rocky gorge. I look them over as we are walking. In spite of their tans, they look very pale. Perspiration is streaming down their grubby faces, and their eyes have a terrified stare. They're afraid because they can sense what our Feldwebel has ordered us to do. I know terror in its many variations from my fighting in Russia, but this must be worse because they can see no escape. The youngest is trembling like a leaf and talking to us non-stop, although he knows that we don't understand him. I reckon the woman can be no more than about 25. She has a narrow, hard face with a strong nose. She slowly goes ahead of us, turning sideways with every step. She wants to look at our faces, but instead stares into the barrels of our carbines, which are relentlessly driving the prisoners forward. I've already agreed with Fritz Hamann what to do next. We force the Italians further into the gorge. As no one can now see us from the road, we yell, as if giving orders, "Avanti! Avanti! Presto!" These are the only words of Italian which come to mind at the moment. Then fire into the air several times. The three prisoners immediately get the picture and scuttle away like rabbits. We hurry back to the rest of our unit. The shots reverberating from the mountainsides must have been proof enough to the Feldwebel that we have carried out his orders, and he doesn't mention the subject again after we confirm that we have indeed done as we were instructed. Although we have disobeyed a direct order and the three partisans have lived to fight another day, neither of us are bothered by our consciences. On the contrary, we are glad that we could extricate ourselves from the affair so successfully. Who knows how it could have ended otherwise? The Feldwebel certainly felt that his command was an acceptable one in time of war, though I have to ask myself, would he personally have carried out the executions? In any case, Fritz Hamann, like me, is one of those people who could never kill in cold blood. Heaven forbid that I should ever become obsessed by such blind hatred that all feeling for fellow human beings is lost, and I could slaughter defenseless men and women. I tell Fritz about my meeting with Unteroffizier Schwarz, and how at the Rychow bridgehead he executed wounded Russian soldiers by shooting them in the head. He explains to me that people who kill the defenseless must have sadistic leanings, and that war provides them with the excuse to satisfy this inhuman trait under the pretext of benefiting the rest of your men. After this period in Italy, we would again be fighting together in Russia for a time, and would kill many of our enemies. But even though war may sometimes cause normal human beings to become insensitive, we would never slay the helpless. 10th of October. The search for partisans is over. Although we have suffered some casualties, compared to the experiences at the Russian front, this has been little more than a hunting expedition. From the Gulf of Rijeka, we drive along the coastal highway by the Adriatic Sea, with a wonderful view over the turquoise blue water, until we arrive at our destination north of Trieste. 11th of October. Arrivederci Italia, molto grazie. Many thanks for your beauty and for your wonderful ancient buildings, which we admire so much. And many thanks for your sparkling sunshine, lifting the sweat out of our pores, and the sea which shone such a wonderful blue colour. We all want to come back another day. Thank you for your fantastic wine, tasting exquisite and quenching our thirsts, even though our heads sometimes got a bit confused due to excessive consumption. It all fits in so wonderfully well in this sun-drenched land with its temperamental people whose melodic voices bubble all around us like a cascading waterfall. All that remains for us now as a memory of this country, and it is a poor consolation, are a few barrels of wine and a dozen bottles of aquavit, which we managed to salvage from a ruined factory on the Dalmatian coast during the last days of our stay. This souvenir helps many of us to overcome our departure from Italy, and even manages to take away gloomy thoughts about our inevitable return to the horrific situation in Russia. Word has quickly spread that an advance command unit is already on the way there. 16th of October. After a few days of relaxation, during which the older company members have indulged in some really heavy drinking, we travel on to a place near Ljubljana into prepared quarters. Here we still have a chance to send packages home. I'm wrapping up a box of good wine and some sheets of soft boot leather that I'd just managed to snatch away from a burning leather factory. 17th of October. We are loaded onto a goods train with our vehicles at the station in Ljubljana. It is cold and rainy, and we are freezing cold in our thin tropical uniforms. 19th of October. We reach Vienna in the early hours of the morning, where we exchange our light uniforms for the regular army issue. Then we travel east, to an unknown destination. Chapter 8. Return to the Russian Inferno. The train has been rattling along towards the east for 2 days now. Those of us who are not busy writing a letter or playing cards with someone, or engrossed in some other activity, are perhaps like me, thinking about things. Many memories come to mind, and I ruminate about what happened last time in Russia and what might be waiting for us there now. But compared to those days, everything is different. It's not just to do with the fact that I now know what war is all about, unlike the first time I came to Russia, full of euphoria and not expecting the terrible disillusionment that came about because of our inconsistent policies there. It has much more to do with the knowledge that I now belong to a hard-hitting combat unit, with well-trained personnel and the necessary heavy weapons, which can take on the strongest enemy and overcome him. I wonder why the negative attitude that I had only a few months ago has changed so quickly into a positive one. The continuous drip-drip of propaganda, with its slogans like "Duty to the Fatherland" and "An honourable contribution for a greater German Reich," has had its effect on me. I'm quite convinced that I'm fighting for a good cause. 22nd of October. We were supposed to disembark today, but after a short stop, we carry on. We can hear booming and thunder all around us. We soldiers don't know anything. We can only guess where we're supposed to be going. We do know that the Russians, after their August offensive, advanced across Kharkov towards the west, and are now somewhere between Kremenchug and Dniepropetrovsk. The newly reconstituted 6th Army, to which we belong, is supposed to be involved in combat in this area. A few hours later, we get down from the train onto an open stretch of track, and we move off in our vehicles, in the general direction of the gunfire. We drive through arid steppe land and through cornfields not yet harvested. The debris of war lies all around us. Russian tanks and artillery pieces, as well as German weapons, providing ample evidence of the to-and-fro movement of combat over the last few weeks. Where is the front line? It is reported to be completely fragmented, and our Rittmeister has to feel his way forward carefully. 23rd of October. We take a rest at the edge of a cornfield, having dispersed the vehicles. We dismount to get circulation back in our feet. The cornfield shimmers like gold in the last rays of the setting sun. The fog is slowly rising from the ground, and I can sense the approach of the Russian winter. The shadows thrown by our vehicles become less harsh, The noise from the artillery fire in front of us becomes louder, and we can already make out tank fire to our flank. The front line is flexing like a headless snake. Although the noise of combat is far away, forward elements of the enemy may actually be behind us. This is what the pilot of a sewing machine must be thinking. Suddenly, out of a clear sky, he is rattling away right overhead. He must have come out of the hollow in front of the cornfield. We stare, amazed, at the Russian biplane, which skims over us, flies up in a spiral, and then, with its engine cut, dives down at us at a steep angle. Has the bloke gone nuts? The pilot leans right out of the cockpit, and we hear him yell in a loud voice, "Ruski! Germanski!" We are speechless. Have you ever heard anything like it? The chap didn't know who it was below him, and yet he dared to fly his unreliable old croc that low. He would have come to no harm had he promptly turned round and gone away. We just gape in astonishment. It doesn't occur to us to fire at him. But the pilot is not satisfied. Because of his thick goggles and the fading light, and because he has not been shot at, he must think the figures beneath him are Ruskies. He makes a tight right-hand turn and comes in at us again at a shallow angle. This time he is greeted with a fusillade of rifle shots. The bullets penetrate the thin skin of the aircraft and hit the engine. The plane falls into the cornfield like a stone from about 30 feet and quickly bursts into fire. Men rush over to the plane and help the pilot out. First he curses like a drunken Cossack, but as he takes off his metal-rimmed goggles and recognizes us as Germanskis, he does not look amused. Then, however, he acknowledges his stupid mistake with a roar of laughter. Jefreiter Rudnik from the Schwadronstrupp offers him a cigarette, which he quickly lights. He has a pack of Papirosa filter tips in his pocket, and these apparently taste better because he throws away our half-smoked cigarette in favour of his own brand.
"Even after the shooting you thought we were your friends, eh?"
Rudnik grins at him, and relieves him of a leather case which he has around his neck containing maps and other valuable documents. Rudnik passes the case to the Rittmeister. The pilot was injured by a glancing bullet on his thigh. He is attended to by the medic, and is later put on board the ambulance. In the meantime, the sun has set. On the western horizon, only a reddish strip is to be seen, and it is growing paler by the minute. "It'll be a nice day tomorrow," says Fritz Koschinski, who is the last to climb on board. We set off slowly on in the dark, and drive on until a motorcycle courier, who has reconnoitred the situation in his armoured reconnaissance vehicle, gives the drivers the signal to stop. There is supposed to be a village ahead of us, occupied by Russians. They are securing an MSR which leads by the village, but this is very little used.
"Dismount!"
The vehicles disperse, and we stand and wait. I can hear our company commander asking the driver of the reconnaissance vehicle about the strength of the Russians in the village, and if there are any tanks nearby. He doesn't know. Then a motorcycle courier turns up, with orders for us to remain in an assembly position until tomorrow morning, until other parts of our outfit can link up with us. Our sector will get some assault gun support in the morning. 24th of October. The weather is sunny, but it is cold and windy. The entire regiment is now in the assembly area, ready for action. As we launch our attack on the village, we make our first contact with the enemy. It is different for me this time compared to Kalach. Here we are the stronger side, and we are able to drive the enemy back. This certainly gives a lift to the ordinary soldier. The village wasn't heavily manned, and the road wasn't used much. However, we capture a lot of weapons, and these are blown up by our engineers. About 60 prisoners are taken and are sent to the rear. The front here is quite confusing. In many places, Russian tanks have already broken through German lines and are now behind us. 29th of October. We drive out of Novaya Praga at daybreak and arrive at our armoured units during the morning. With them, we attack the enemy. During our attack, we are constantly bombarded by artillery and Stalinorgeln. We suffer casualties and must constantly dig ourselves in. A fellow in our unit, Heinz Bartsch, one of our ammunition carriers, is severely wounded in the head, and shortly afterwards our Italian volunteer, whom we call Marco, has his shoulder ripped open by shrapnel. Kilometre after kilometre we push the enemy back, and when it gets dark, some of us soldiers, including me, suddenly find ourselves in the middle of some men who start talking to us in Russian. There are 10 of them, and in the darkness they have been unable to retreat quickly enough. They surrender without a fight. We continue to advance with the tanks in the darkness, stopping now and then, dismounting and continuing on foot. We have strict orders from the Schwadronschef that at each long stop we are to dig ourselves in. Fritz Koschinski, who belongs to our group, has got hold of a long-handled shovel from one of the vehicles, enabling us to dig a hole in the ground much more quickly than with the small folding field shovels. During our advance there are quite a number of these stops. I reckon that in the last few days I have dug more holes in Russian soil than I have ever dug in my entire life in our garden at home. I've got burst blisters on my hands, and I curse this confounded digging on more than one occasion. But I appreciate how important it is to have a foxhole when we find ourselves in the open fields during an artillery barrage, or if we are surprised by Soviet aircraft. 30th of October. Today we are attacking the enemy west of the river Ingules, near Ternovatka. In spite of heavy enemy fire, we succeed, with the help of other companies and an anti-tank gun platoon, to establish a small bridgehead on the east side of the river. At the start of the action, we lose a 20mm anti-aircraft gun and a tank destroyer to tank fire. Both vehicles are completely burnt out. The AAG crew are dead, and the tank destroyer personnel have severe burns all over their bodies. Notwithstanding the darkness, our Rittmeister wants to reconnoitre the small village of Nedaivoda, forward of our position. A reconnaissance platoon reports that the houses in the village are in rows either side of a small stream. In the village itself, they have detected only light enemy units, although alongside a hedge they have discovered a T-34 securing one of the streets, which is not much used.
"Good. We'll get the tank first," I hear our chief say.
Our vehicles remain undercover while we advance towards the village in small groups. The Schwadronstrupp, with our Rittmeister in front, is accompanied by a 75mm self-propelled anti-tank gun. We creep forward very carefully, and when the guide gives the signal, the engine of the ATG is immediately cut. The closer we get to the tank, the more circumspect we are. We can often hear low engine noises, and every now and then hushed calls in the night. Gingerly, we feel our way forward. The engine on the ATG runs quietly, and the tracks move easily over the ground. It is almost completely dark, but every now and then the area is bathed in pale moonlight as the clouds waft across the sky. In front of us, we can see the shadows of the bushes and houses. Orders are whispered. We fan out in a line.
"Keep in touch. Advance slowly and more carefully. We have time."
Orders from the Rittmeister. The ATG is now advancing at a snail's pace. There in front of us is the hedge. The tank is supposed to be standing there somewhere. If we are spotted, we will have lost the element of surprise, and he will open fire on us at point-blank range. We advance along the hedge very carefully. The twigs snag on our ammunition pouches, and we stop immediately and melt into the shadows of the hedge. The ATG edges forward a yard at a time. Where is the tank? As if in answer, a diesel engine suddenly starts up. The noise comes from the right, in front of us. There, where the hedge makes an angle with the houses and the street curves away. Has he discovered us? The excitement frays our nerves. If a flare goes up, the excitement is over, but then all hell will break loose. We hold our breath, and the ATG cuts its engine. But the gunner cranks down the barrel and swings it over to aim it at the spot where the diesel engine noise came from. We soldiers press ourselves flat on the ground and stare into the darkness. The tank noise sounds loud and nervous, but nothing happens.
"We have to move closer," I hear the Rittmeister whisper. "He can't hear us because of his engine."
The ATG moves ahead very carefully, its crew ready to open up at a second's notice. We walk along bent double in the cover of the houses. Then, suddenly, the tank engine is cut. The ATG immediately does likewise. It is so nerve-wracking. The Russian tank crew is probably staring into the darkness just like us, uncertain exactly what to do. It's probably not a good idea to send up a flare with the enemy right under their noses. The best thing would be to get away out of here as quickly as possible, so as to gain a little distance. That must have been what the tank crew were thinking when they discovered us, because at that point the engine roars into life and we can hear the tracks move across the ground. Our eyes have got so used to the darkness that we can clearly see the outline of the vehicle. Just as the recce unit reported, it had been sitting right by the hedge, and it is now moving away under cover of the bushes. The ATG gunner aims at the dark mass. The moon appears again, causing the matte silver gun barrel to glint.
Ready!
A voice breaks the tension. There is a dull report, and a bolt of white lightning streaks through the night, bathing everything around us in brightness. Blinded, we look at the T-34, which is no more than 30 meters away and broadside on. Along the hedge, we see some figures running for cover. A shot rents the air, and the almost instantaneous explosion of the ATG round tears a hole the size of a man's fist in the side of the tank. Seconds later, another round finds the target, and in the light of a tracer, we see black smoke billowing out of the tank's turret hatch. The hatch is ripped open, and holding one hand against a bleeding head wound, a Russian jumps out and hurries down to the stream. We are lying in the hedge firing at the Russians, who appear between the houses and fire back at us, but within a short time we have either inflicted casualties or forced the enemy to flee. We don't have time to search through all the houses, but instead we take up our positions in front of the village, which we assume the enemy will make an effort to retake. 31st of October. During the next few hours a hard and bitter firefight develops, but we are able to hold the enemy back. Our ATG destroys 5 T-34s. Later, another 7 are captured, having run out of fuel and been abandoned by their crews. The enemy infantry, pushed back, have dug in only a few hundred meters from our positions, but most of them can avoid our fire by staying hidden in a hollow just 100 meters away. We selected this hillock at the edge of the village for our HMGs because of the excellent view it commands, but there is this shallow depression with tall grass growing in it, offering concealment. It is also impossible for us to control the banks of the stream to the right of us, where our light platoons are stationed, because of the bushes there. As a result, the enemy attack from the bank of the stream comes as a surprise. We get our first sight of the attackers when their earth-coloured helmets appear out of the shallow depression. The first waves are mown down by the murderous fire from our two heavy machine guns, and those behind now fall back down into the hollow. And then something happens that makes our hair stand on end. We witness, first-hand and close-up, the inhuman treatment meted out to Soviet soldiers by their leaders, and we have real sympathy for the poor devils. Because of the firepower from our two MG-42s, at a range of about 50 meters, the attackers have little chance of getting out of the hollow, and certainly none at all of storming up the hillock to our positions. We have heard how the commissar forces his men forward with a shrill whistle, as if he were controlling a pack of mad dogs. We fire as soon as we can see their torsos. Anyone who manages to come up over the edge of the hollow can't get further than one or at best two paces forward before he is hit. Those who fall back still alive are cursed and sworn at as if they were animals. Is this Russian commissar or officer crazy? Or is he only worried about his own life, and is therefore sacrificing his men? It can't have escaped his notice that he is caught in a trap, and that when daylight comes he'll have no chance to get away. Does he intend to sacrifice his troops until evening comes, to tie us down so that he can secretly make a getaway under the cover of darkness? But the death that awaits him, and unfortunately also the other poor devils, is worse than death from a bullet. The tanks move up, two of them on the right flank peeling off from the others and moving towards the hollow. I note their fat barrels, which, unlike the other tank guns, are pointed down towards the ground. Fritz Kaczynski knows his equipment. "Flamethrowers," he says in a voice so loud that we can all hear him. I've heard about their effect, and my spine starts to shiver. I wouldn't like to be one of those chaps in the hollow, and the crazy bastard will probably lose the whistle he keeps blowing. There is now no chance of anyone getting out of the hollow alive. I ask myself if the slavish obedience of the Russian soldiers goes so far, even in this situation, as to prevent them from liquidating an inhuman superior officer. Even before the flamethrower has disappeared into the hollow, we can see the long jet of flame as it spews out of the barrel and burns everything in its path to a crisp. Panic erupts in the hollow. We can hear all the yelling. And with the thick black smoke comes an unbelievable stench of burnt flesh and clothing. Some of the men are running up and out of the hollow, crying and ablaze. Panic-stricken, they run past us and throw themselves on the ground, rolling over and over. Many have jumped into the stream in order to save themselves. The heat is so intense that we can feel it from here. It is a truly terrible sight. We climb out of our foxholes and follow the advancing tanks. We have to go on. The destruction of the enemy has not been accomplished yet. After a kilometer, we receive strong counterfire. The enemy has dug himself in. When we're unable to advance any further, four more flamethrower tanks attack from the flank. This is a terrible weapon. I'm experiencing its destructive power for the first time, and I won't easily forget the terrible stench that takes my breath away and threatens to suffocate me. 1st of November. We have many dead and wounded in our unit on this day. Later, our successful engagement for the bridgehead near Ternovatka will be mentioned in the German Army Rolls of Honour under the name of our Rittmeister. This kind of special award is used to try and get units motivated. 2nd of November. We are travelling at high speed to a new sector. We, the ordinary soldiers, are left in ignorance as usual, but rumour has it that we are making for a bridgehead on the Dnieper. We drive through the night and freeze on board the trucks. For the last 2 days it has been freezing during the night and raining during the day, and the awful strong wind blows right through our limbs. The ground is muddy, and the vehicles frequently get bogged down to their axles. When we board the trucks after we have helped to heave them out of the mud, the sticky black Ukrainian clay clings to our boots and our uniforms. Finally, we stop in a village and move into quarters, where we receive new felt boots and padded camouflage suits for the winter that is imminent. 5th of November. We are back in a defensive position around a large market town called Vyakny Rogachik. The main battle line is supposed to be quite near. We can hear gunfire and other noises of battle in the distance. We are told that the Russians have broken through our lines on a wide front. Our regiment, with the support of artillery and tanks, is supposed to attack in the early morning hours to try to re-establish the old front line. 6th of November. Following a prolonged bombardment by heavy and medium artillery, we advance on a wide front against the enemy. The Soviets greet us with a huge defensive barrage. As the sun gets up, it blinds our tank gunners, so that they frequently have to stop and have a lot of problems getting the targets in their sights. It develops into a murderous attack, with high casualties in both officers and men. We have many dead. Right beside me, an Unteroffizier has his head blown off by an artillery shell. A grenade splinter rips open the ammunition drum mounted on my machine gun. In spite of our heavy losses, we manage to break through the Russian defences and drive the enemy fleeing before us. The flamethrower tanks take over the task of mopping up the resistance in the foxholes and trenches. They leave behind a desolate and singed landscape, from which for hours a stinking cloud of smoke rises to pollute the air. This merges with the moving white clouds in the sky, carrying the remains of the burnt corpses over a wide tract of the endless countryside. Just as we think we might be able to take things a bit easy today, the Russians counterattack. They take us by surprise with a devastating barrage from their Stalinorgeln and field howitzers. Again, we suffer a great number of casualties, but as we in the meantime have been backed up by yet another section of Hornissa heavy tank destroyers, and in addition some Hummels with their 150mm howitzers, the enemy has no chance of breaking through in our sector. At about this time, our Stukas start to attack the enemy's assembly areas, and we see the clouds of black smoke rising into the sky, indicating that they have hit their targets. After we've mopped up the old frontline positions, the 79th Infantry Division reoccupy their previous positions. Tonight we move on to a new sector, this time near Verkhny Rogatchik again. The Russian defences are weak here. We're told later that we have defeated a Russian Guards Artillery Division with their guns and other heavy weapons, and have also caused heavy casualties in men and equipment among two further Guards divisions. But our victory has cost us dear. There are more than 20 dead in our section alone, and for our regiment the total losses amount to the strength of an entire company, about 155 men. Along with the many soldiers, Unteroffiziere and Wachtmeistern, there were also a number of officers killed, among them the commanders of the 1st and 2nd battalions, and three company commanders. In our heavy weapons platoon we lost one mortar and one heavy machine gun section. To everyone's regret, and to our rage, our beloved Unteroffizier Faber was killed by a pistol bullet in the back, fired by a Bolshevik officer who was lying wounded on the ground, and whom he had just bandaged. It made me think of Unteroffizier Schwarz, who at the bridgehead near Rychow had done this sort of thing, which I reckoned was inhuman. This time I was not so much concerned, as a Wachtmeister from one of the light platoons shot the bastard with a burst from his submachine gun. God prevent my anger developing into such an intense hatred that I will ever become like Schwarz. 7th of November. Days later we miss our highly respected Rittmeister, who could always be found in the very first of our front lines. Our Zugführer tells us that he has been ordered by higher command to take over the decimated battalion, and we are to get another company commander. In the meantime, word has spread that we are, with the entire division, now at the strategically important bridgehead of Nikopol on the Dnieper. The weather has changed. Although it is freezing throughout the night, during the morning it begins to rain. The ground has become nothing but slime. Even tracked vehicles have problems trying to make it through. Most of the time we wade through the sludge, pushing our vehicles. After hours of exhausting work, we reached Dnieprovka, a large village at the eastern end of the bridgehead. We are soaked through and completely covered in mud and slime. The staffs of an infantry division and a mountain infantry unit are supposed to be stationed in the village, and their fighting elements are reported to be dug in along the MBL, defending it against a continually attacking enemy. 8th of November. We occupy the quarters relinquished by the men of an army tank unit. Our unit moves into a roomy wooden house, which we call a panier hut. Here we find a Russian woman living with her 18-year-old daughter, Katya. Both live in the front room with the great clay oven, on which, according to Russian custom, both women have their beds. All of us soldiers move into the next room, which is large and is also heated by the clay oven. Outside it is clammy and raw cold, and before we clean up after the other occupants, we stoke up the oven. Chapter 9. Alarm at the Nikopol Bridgehead. We spend the next 10 days, 9th to the 19th of November, in Dnieprovka, in anticipation of being ordered to counterattack. We know that the MBL runs a few kilometres south of the village, and that the position on the left side is occupied by the men of the 3rd Mountain Division. Adjoining them on the right are the foxholes and trenches of part of the 258th Infantry Division. Both units are seriously depleted, owing to the hard combat during the summer months. They have to defend a wide sector with greatly reduced manpower and weaponry against a very well-equipped enemy force. The soldiers in my unit talk about this and pity the poor devils who have been in the front line for so long and still have to live in the wet and muddy foxholes and fight the enemy. We, as a far better equipped unit, have been upgraded to an elite force with the mission to attack only when the enemy has broken through our lines. Since we also enjoy the privilege of returning to our quarters after a successful action, unlike the troops manning the front line positions, we are that much more respected. After the fighting here at the bridgehead, our losses are so high that of the three light companies, not one could be completely reformed, despite our having been continuously reinforced with replacements. When the battle at the Nikopol bridgehead was finally over, 2 full months of hard fighting was behind us. We no longer have a group leader, so our Zugführer has assigned the veterans Waldemar Krekel and Fritz Koschinski as squad leaders, giving them submachine guns to carry. My second gunner is the strong Gefreiter Willy Krause. Fritz Hamann, who up to now had been my second gunner, has himself taken over a heavy machine gun after Obergefreiter Heinz Bartsch was seriously wounded by a direct hit from an ATG. His number two is now Panzergrenadier Bittner, one of the younger generation. 2 fallen ammunition carriers in our team are being replaced by 1 volunteer helper and Panzergrenadier Mersch. Our mortar team is also being reorganized. Unteroffizier Fender has now taken over from Wachtmeister Hauk, who was badly wounded. Besides Varias, the only other people in the team I still know are Gefreiten Erik Schuster and Günther Pfeiffer. The team has moved into the neighboring house, and sometimes the three of them come over to play cards. The others are mostly new arrivals. Otto Krupke now belongs to the Zugtrupp and is also the personal ordnance of our Oberwachtmeister, whom we only call Ober among ourselves. Spies always sets a good example at the front lines, but he is an experienced old-timer and is therefore careful enough to avoid taking major risks. This benefits us in the heavy machine gun team, as because of our heavy firepower, we are generally given the task of fire support to the light platoons in the attacks, and are thus spared any close combat engagements. As a replacement for the Rittmeister, an Oberleutnant took command of our Schwadron for a short time. During his command, some of the more enterprising soldiers organized a sauna in an empty house, an excellent idea, and we made good use of it. Right from the start, Weichert and I had a good relationship with Katja, the daughter of Matka, our landlady. Katja works half a day, and her mother works the whole day in the kitchen for the mountain troops. Katja is a slim, blonde Russian girl, a so-called panienka. She wears her hair in small braids, woven like a wreath around her head. She dresses in a large Russian frock, which was once light blue, but is now bleached to a grey. Every morning she exudes cleanliness, and when she comes closer, she smells of plain military-issue soap. As soon as she sees us, she greets us with the usual Russian Stradsvuitye, good day, and her eyes light up like cornflowers. I think that were Katya to dress in fashionable clothes, she would be a charming and attractive young lady. Although we had orders that because of the risks of espionage and partisan activity, no close contact must be made with the civilian population, it so happens that we have to discuss a number of matters with Matka and with Katya. Misha, our volunteer helper, who also comes from the Ukraine, serves as interpreter. Later on, I learn a little bit of Russian, and I am able to make myself understood when I or some of the others need something. Weichert is usually the one to take advantage of this. He is always appearing with a chicken from somewhere, which he wants Katya and Matka to prepare. There is even a little flirting between us soldiers and Katya, and she is greatly amused when we pronounce Russian words incorrectly, or when she tries to say something in German. However, none of us thinks seriously of trying it on with her. She is definitely off limits in that sense. Over the days and weeks, Katya becomes for us a sort of guardian angel. It all began as we returned to our quarters from combat one day, wet and frozen to the marrow, and found our room pleasantly warm and spotlessly clean. Even our straw beds had been freshly arranged. She continues to look after us in this way day after day, and to show our appreciation we give her lots of pieces of chocolate from our army rations. She once asked us for a pair of socks for her mother, and immediately received several pairs, and also some underclothing. She even got a tropical issue khaki shirt. She looked quite fetching in it. She was as pleased as Punch, and looked herself over in the half-broken mirror hanging on the wall in her room. But when we have to go off to another engagement, she looks serious, and I often see tears in her eyes. As we sit in the trucks, she always comes up to say goodbye to us, and to wave until we are out of sight. On many occasions, she has come running up at the last minute because she's been down in the village peeling potatoes when the alarm sounds. 22nd of November. We had frost again during the night, and during the early morning it starts to drizzle. This rain softens the ground once more, and we are soon up to our ankles in mud. Ahead, along the MBL, heavy fighting is underway, but after an hour we are told that the enemy has been forced to fall back to the south. The commander of the 2nd Company has fallen, along with several of the men from his Schwadronstrupp. But the successes are played up. The static AAG platoon of the division, which inflicted more than 50 casualties among the enemy using their weapon in the ground support role, and our capture of some T-34s and destruction of 16 ATGs and a number of field guns. We're still in the assembly area awaiting orders to engage the enemy. It's been rather quiet during the night, and with Willy Krauser, my number two, I've cleaned up our foxhole of clay and mud and covered the base with step grass and a couple of planks from an ammunition box. This lifts our spirits, and we now try to get some sleep, standing up in the roughly 2 meter deep hole. 23rd of November. Early in the morning, we are woken up by a heavy enemy artillery barrage, which is concentrated on the infantry positions on our right flank. While we are listening to the barrage and hoping against hope that they will be able to hold out, our thoughts are interrupted by the loudest and most terrifying engine noises we have ever heard. The walls of our foxhole vibrate, and the ground shakes as if an earthquake has hit us. The roar increases and then reverberates from the walls. Slowly, a huge object hauls itself along the floor of the Rachel. It is nearly as big as a house, and it has a long barrel pointing out in front of it. Then I count four of the steel monsters, bigger than anything I have ever seen before. They move forward at a walking pace on very wide steel tracks. All the soldiers get up out of their foxholes and look at these giants. Even the old-timers amongst us have no explanation. Then the news spreads like wildfire. These are Ferdinands, new 75-ton tank destroyers with an 88mm gun and a special sight which enables them to destroy enemy tanks at unheard-of ranges. An Unteroffizier from the crew informs us that the monsters are each powered by two huge diesel motors and two electric motors. They move on extra-wide tracks, but even so still sink into the mud. Rain and mud are their worst enemies, capable of rendering them totally immobile. So the Ferdinands are better suited for positional and defensive combat. For the moment, five of them are being assigned to this sector on a trials basis. Whilst on the subject of these Ferdinand tank destroyers, I'd like to mention here an incident that took place a few days later, illustrating the effect they had on the enemy. We had stopped an enemy attack and delivered a counter-attack. In support of our advance were four assault guns and four Ferdinands. As the enemy disappeared into a field of sunflowers and we took over his positions, a total of 22 T-34 tanks began to roll towards us. The assault guns and the Ferdinands had moved into a Rachel behind us and were well out of sight. They waited until the T-34s had closed to a favourable range, and as soon as they opened fire, six of the enemy tanks were immediately destroyed. All the other T-34s stopped dead, though they returned fire straight away. When the guns behind us roared again, the turrets of three more T-34s were sent flying through the air, and two more T-34s were set on fire. The rest of the T-34s turned and ran, halting at a respectful distance and turning around to face us again. 11 T-34s were now standing at what they believed to be a safe distance, out of range of our tanks and ATGs. But they were mistaken, and what happened next was unbelievable. The Ferdinands moved up a little, out of the Rachel, so as to get a better view. The T-34s had in the meantime taken up positions in line on the top of a small hillock to observe us. I could see them better through the telescopic sight of my machine gun. The four Ferdinands then fired almost simultaneously, and I could clearly see the glowing shells explode among the T-34s, two of which began to smoke. Two hits. Quite incredible at this distance. The enemy tanks started to move off, but the Ferdinands continued to fire, and again they hit one of the T-34s. The rest of the enemy tanks were by this time in a great hurry to get behind the hillock. The Russians must by now have begun to wonder what kind of weapon they were confronted with. We were all convinced that from now on the Ferdinand would be the great nemesis of the T-34. As the enemy infantry was no more than 300 meters in front of us in the sun